Log Talk Radio.
The streets don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your hosts Boyd and Lucinda for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today's February 10th, 2010. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And as always, our topic is the Streets Don't Love You Back. Join us every Wednesday night as we talk with real people, hearing real stories and real changes. As we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and a lot of other life issues. Tonight we have a fantastic show for you with our guest, Mr. John Telford. John's known as an activist educator. He's a former All-American sprinter and recently wrote an autobiography called A Life on the Run, which he recounts his battles against bigots and sometimes scandalous love affairs and his fight for racial equality. So we will talk with him in just a few moments. I'd like to welcome Boyd to the show.
Yes, how you doing tonight, everybody? And we are glad to have you right here at the Streets Don't Love You Back radio show. And it might be a little noisy in the background because I'm riding on the Greyhound bus right now. But we definitely are going to have a great show tonight with my man John. And we're looking to let everybody know about his new book as well, Life on the Run. And John will be telling you where you can go pick that book up at as well. So right now we're going to get right on into the show. And we're going to pass the mic to my man, John. And we're going to ask John to introduce himself fully, and we're going to get started.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rod and Lucinda. It's a privilege and pleasure to be on your show. I'm speaking here from Detroit, Michigan. My name is John Telford, Dr. John Telford to some folks. And I've written my autobiography. I'm 74 years old, so I figure time to write. Title is A Life on the Run, Seeking and Safeguarding Social Justice.
All right. John, why don't you go back and before you tell us a little bit about, your book is obviously about your life, but go back to maybe your childhood and let us know kind of where you grew up, what happened to you, and just go from there.
Okay, well, I came up in Detroit on 16th Street in McGraw. Folks in Detroit will know where that is. It's a little bit east of the old Olympia Stadium. I came up there 1936 to 1950, and then I came out of Estabrook Elementary School and lived in McGraw. I spent a little time in the youth home for doing something I shouldn't have. And then I went to Northwestern High School, which is in Detroit, and I got put out of there for a little difficulty, and I got sent to live with my father. My father was an ex-boxer, he had raised me when I was little, but he was a Scot. He had a little difficulty with alcohol and with gambling, and my mother put him out, although she never could stay away from him for too long. They got back together again. When I was over on the east side. And then on the east side, I ended up getting an athletic scholarship out of high school to Denby. From Denby High School, I went to Wayne State. And I was an All-America sprinter there my senior year. I ended up on the United States team, ran some Olympic champions, and it was a good thing for me because the sport kind of gave me some focus, and it got me educated and graduated, and I ended up then coaching and teaching in inner city Detroit for a number of years, and also administrating in the schools, Detroit Public Schools.
Oh, that sounds great, John. And another thing, I just want to go and ask you, John, when you was raised over there on 16th and McGraw, you know, can you tell the audience how was it in your life at the time when you was growing up over there and what led you to doing any kind of wrong at that time?
Well, when my mother kicked my father out, you know, I kind of started running with some of the wrong people. And, my mother really couldn't control that. You know, I was coming home at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, when I was 14 years old, just basically doing some bad things. I won't get into the particulars of it, I guess I could. Well, no, no sense doing that. I mean, my story is not that dissimilar from a lot of kids, you know, who came up kind of hard down there. But one of the good things that happened with me was that when my father was in the house on 16th and McGraw, he kept a pretty tight hand on me, and he steered me in a kind of an egalitarian direction, because he was an old Scot. Well, he wasn't so old then. He was a young Scot. But, the Scots are kind of freedom-loving, and he was he came up hard, too. He was in the coal mines when he was, and so was his father. They were coal miners, these guys. They were coal miners. They were boxers. My grandfather was a boxer in the old country when they didn't have gloves. And my father was a boxer. He turned pro at 16 in Detroit. And when he was raising me over on the west side, he taught me a lot of things that the Scots held dear. You know, the love of freedom. Defend the underdog, never take a step back. Drilled a lot of the old code, you know, the William Wallace code into my little Telfordian head when I was 2 years old, you know.
Right. So I'm going to pass the mic over to my missus and let her ask you some things, John.
Okay.
I was just going to say that you're one of the lucky ones that did have your father, because I guess if you didn't, you'd probably maybe have stayed on that wrong path, and lucky to have someone that coached you into doing better things.
Yeah, well, he taught me righteousness, and he taught me to defend the underdog. I can remember, you know, and I talk about some of those things in the book. If your listeners want to order it, it's at www.alifeontherun.com. That's www.alifeontherun.com. A Life on the Run, Seeking and Safeguarding Social Justice, because that was what my father did. You know, he sought and safeguarded social justice, and he taught me to do the same thing. Never forget one time, 1943, I was 7 years old, you know, I saw him face down a mob that were, they had this old black man already on his knees, you know, stomping them during the riots in Detroit, and he backed them off because they knew his fistic capabilities. It was over on Stanton and McGraw, I still remember the corner, it was in the alley. And he carried the old man home, you know, and I carried his dentures home. I picked him up off the pavement, and my mother cleaned him up. My dad drove him home in the morning, but they had beaten him pretty bad. And that old man, he's a really old man. He died a couple of years later, but I can remember it was a couple of weeks later. He died a couple of weeks later. And I'm sure that what that mob did to him had something to do with his passing, even though he was like almost 90 years old. You know, but I could tell a lot of similar stories about my father. And I did. You know, I put two or three of those stories in the early part of the book, because the book starts around 1938, 39, and it goes all the way really until now. Last year when they fired me out of the superintendency of the Madison schools for bringing in the kids from Detroit. You know, they're a bunch of white racists that didn't like what I was doing then. But I was already in my 70s then, so the book is kind of a panorama of about, you know, close to, you know, 70, three quarters of a century.
All right.
When the young white kids didn't like what you was doing, John, what did you do to show them that, you know, you didn't care what they thought?
Doing that my whole life. What part of when are we talking about now?
when the young white children didn't like you helping out the blacks at the school?
Well, you know, the most recent thing I did, and of course that's real recent, was I was a superintendent in the Madison District Public Schools, and I was bringing kids from Detroit in. But it wasn't young folks that were upset with me for doing that. It was some grown men, you know, who came to a town hall meeting screaming for my scalp. They, you know, this was all on local television. In fact, my wife Gina's got it all on tape.
Was this last year, John?
Say that again, Lucinda. I didn't hear
you. Was that last year?
This was in early, late 2008, early 2009. And the district was a couple million dollars in debt, just a little tiny district. Kind of the tail end of my career. I came up in the Detroit Public Schools, okay? I came up as a teacher and coach and administrator back in the 50s and 60s. And then I ended up administrating in some suburban districts. Rochester was one of them when I was deputy superintendent. In Rochester, I was pioneering the hire of black principals, and that's a whole long story, too. You know, they shot up my house in the middle of the night it was 1989. You'd think we would have thought it was Birmingham, Alabama, 1920, you know, but the most recent one, you know, I'm skipping up from 1991 now to 2009, was when I was bringing in the kids from Detroit in an open enrollment program, because the district was really deep in debt, and we bring the kids in from Detroit, we were giving them a better education, The situation was such that a couple hundred folks showed up at a town hall meeting screaming for my scalp, and the board of education actually buckled. You know, they gave them my scalp. In a way, I couldn't blame them. You know, because they were scared. You know, they were afraid these guys were gonna, you know, egg their cars, break their windows. I mean, they had to live in the district. But it was a bit of a shock to me that these guys were so virulent. I mean, just simply coming and saying right on the TV cameras, we don't want any more black kids walking down our streets. I mean, they actually came out and said something like that, and not just once. They were saying it repeatedly.
It's hard to believe that in the year 2009, people are still acting like that.
Well, it's very discouraging to see this kind of thing. I mean, it's something that my father fought. It's something that I've been fighting my entire career, and beyond my career. I'm still doing it. But the fact is that the Detroit area is the most segregated urban center in the country, and there's a good reason for that. There's an awful lot of prejudice. I've served on various boards in my time. I was on the Open Housing Board. I was on the Pontiac Area Urban League Board. Real close to the NAACP director, Hester Wheeler, you know, he's my buddy. The president, Wendell Anthony, I was on his TV show. And I've been pretty much telling my story, and I'm going to continue to do it. And I appreciate the opportunity to do it in Cincinnati.
All right,
we definitely appreciate that. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was just going to say that we're happy to have you on the show to be able to tell your story. And, you know, everybody, I mean, I'm kind of like you, John. I hate that people are prejudiced, you know, and it just really, really bothers me that people can't see people as human beings because, you know, there's good and bad in every race. It doesn't matter what you are.
Well, babies, you know, babies weren't born hating people. The roots of prejudice in this country are embedded in the ancient greed of the slave traders and in the rapaciousness of the Europeans who stole this land from the Native Americans. And now, in current child rearing in some families, they're transmitting racism and other forms of bigotry. You know, babies aren't born with prejudice. They have to be taught to hate. And this is... this is something that that we as educators have to address. You know, I've been a superintendent, I've been a deputy superintendent, I've served in the inner city, I've served in suburbs. One of the things that I found when I came back to Detroit, after running some suburban districts, I'd be coming back, welcome with open arms, because of my egalitarian ideals. But one of the things that really shocked me was that I found administrators, top administrators, who were exploiting poor kids. And just taking care of the elite kids in the district. And these administrators were black, they weren't white. And I clashed with them almost immediately. I came back and I taught and coached track for the first time in 30-some years in Detroit because, track is my major sport. I had champions, state champions back in the 60s. So I came back to, have a little bit of fun. But I can remember then when Ken Burnley came to town, he put me in charge of the southwest side of town, the secondary schools, and I had a little difficulty with his top lieutenant right away. Not because she was necessarily exploiting kids, but because she just was making some key mistakes that were not good for the kids. So I got fired. I got fired. And I went and ran the team for justice for a year over in Gratiot and Mount Elliott, and then Burnley fired her at the end of the year and brought me back to be the executive director of community affairs. And when he brought me back, I said, "No, you're not going to fire me again, now, are you? Because I got this really good job."
What'd you say, John? You ain't gonna fire me again with me trying to do my job, right, huh?
Yeah, but a year later, I got fired again. I won't say her name on the radio, but she was the chief of staff, and she gagged my community liaisons and told them that they couldn't go to community leaders without clearing it with her. It's kind of like telling Muhammad Ali to stay out of the ring.
Right.
And you can't tell Muhammad Ali back in the young days to stay out the ring because that's what he did. He boxed.
Exactly. Well, this lady was very, I don't know, she was kind of paranoid. I think she was afraid my liaisons were going to say something bad to some community leaders about her. I don't know. But anyway, she fired me again. And then one of my proteges who I had put over at Finney High, Al Ward, probably the best principal in the city. He had been principal of Western when I was supervising him. Al Ward kind of came to my rescue and asked me to help him run his school, Finney High School. The school was really wild, and he was having a lot of trouble with kids in the school, particularly some administrative transfers. They're called ATs, administrative transfers. They were getting transferred into the school for misbehavior, and we were getting, a couple hundred of them in there, every month. So he asked me to come and help him run the school, which I did. Between 2003 and 2007, and in the course of that, I taught some classes too, and I became probably the oldest retired superintendent in the country, black or white, urban or suburban, who dared to go back and teach in inner city high school. And I was still doing it in my 70s and loving it. I was having a really good time.
That's good. So you call yourself a teacher activist. What can you explain about that?
Well, I'm both an educator and a social activist. As a teacher, I've always taught my kids righteous activism, and to become righteous activists, as well as instructing them in the relevant academic discipline. As an activist, I have used my classroom and my administrative positions and my newspaper columns and my radio show and now my book to inspire my students, my colleagues, my constituents, and readers and listeners to become socially aware. Yeah, as well as in my students' case, to become academically grounded. I call my kids my All-American Activist Armies. I did this way back in the 1950s, and I was still doing it in the 2008, you know, because, you know, they need to know that the limits of their language are the limits of their world. I taught them to handle the language better than they were handling it, because in order to become activists and to become successful in the workaday world, they have to be able to master the language before they can do anything else.
Right. What have you seen over the past 50 years in the school system as far as the biggest struggle with kids to become righteous and positive activists?
Well, you know, kids are basically the same now as they were when I started teaching in the 1950s. It's not the kids who have changed so much as it's the social conditions. They've become much worse. When I was teaching and coaching the Southeastern High School, you know, back in the late 50s, early 60s, we had our share of social problems. You know, some of the kids came out of some real rough environments. But now an overwhelming majority of the kids are coming out of that same real rough environment. And whereas in those days, you know, it would be maybe cheap wine and fists, you know, a knife now and then. Now we're talking about, you know, about
weapons.
Right.
Just listen up real quick.
Right. We have guns and drugs and all kinds of stuff now that interfere in all the kids' activities.
Yeah, I went to a lot of funerals when I was running Detroit SNAP, the Safe Neighborhoods Action Plan. I was executive director of Detroit SNAP. I was working out of a police mini station on Shane, and doing my best, you know, to turn some of these gang kids around. I got to admit that I wasn't as successful as I would have liked to be. I was going to a lot of funerals. These kids were, you know, they were hurting each other over stupid things, you know. Shoes and coats, you know, fancy coats and girls, and their sisters were, you know, doing some bad stuff in dope houses, and their little brothers were running drugs. But at Finney, it was we had a kid stomped to death, and I never forgot it. It was just, again, stupid stuff, you know. It wasn't like the drug runners on the Southwest, you know. It was just stupid stuff. This one kid, I'll never forget, the kid's name was James Scott, and he came into the school with some of his homies. You know, they were going to get this kid that had insulted his sister. Well, what happened was when they came into the school, I was up on the second floor breaking up a fight, and they were down on the first floor when they came into the school, and my kids beat them up, chase them out the school. But this one kid, James Scott, headed down the wrong corridor toward the auditorium where we had the door chain, and he got cornered. They jumped on his head, stomped him to death. There were girls even kicking him in the ribs. We got it in on the it was terrible. We got it on the camera, you know.
Uh-huh.
But by the time I got down there and the principal got down there, Al Ward, I lifted this kid's eyelid, and it was real clear to me. I mean, he was bleeding from his eyes, you know, not just his mouth. He was bleeding from his ears. His head was crooked. They had been jumping up and down on his head. I told Al, I said, this kid's not waking up. It took the EMS about 45 minutes to get across town because they don't have that many units, you know, on the street now because of the... I say now, this was the year 2007.
Right.
When that happened. And it's a really helpless feeling. You know, I had to talk to that kid's mother at the funeral. It was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. Kid comes into the school alive and leaves it dead. You know, that's not what educators are supposed to be allowing to happen.
Exactly. Yeah, that's... It's just, you know, too bad that all that has to happen.
Yeah, well, that was the low point of my 5 years at Finney. It was the absolute low point.
Right. Were you teaching in Detroit there during the 80s when the big crack cocaine industry kind of moved in?
No. In the 80s, I was administrating in districts that were suburbs of Detroit.
Okay.
In fact, in the 80s, that's when I was the deputy superintendent in Rochester, and I was pioneering the hire of African-American administrators. At the time, Rochester was the only district doing that, basically because I was aggressively recruiting and hiring some of my cohorts from the city, because I was of the mind that the kids in Rochester needed to see black men and women in leadership positions,
right.
Because that's the real world, you know, or Rochester just, you know, a little enclave, but that's the real world. So I was bringing in some real good black administrators that I had brought in from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Rochester, Michigan was the district.
Okay.
And they shot up my house in the middle of the night. That was where they shot up my house.
That's when they shot
my
house.
Yeah, 90. I was living in Rochester Hills, and they shot my house up in the middle of the night. And, you know, they were putting excrement in my mailbox and doing all kinds of, sending bad letters, you know, making phone calls.
Those are white people doing that because you brought in black teachers.
Yeah. I wasn't bringing black kids in then, but we had black kids. We had about 250 black kids in a district with maybe 13, 14,000 kids. And you know, when a group of white parents came to a board meeting screaming for my job, very similar, you know, this was 1990, you know, very similar to what happened to me in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
But that time out in Rochester, I only had, you know, 250 black kids, you know, but their parents were 500. You know, those were kids who were basically in two-parent families. Almost every one of those 500 parents showed up at a board meeting and saved my job. And
right.
They were all joined by a group calling itself Upward, which was a group of white Christians and also some Jewish parents. And they called themselves Upward, United Parents Working, UP, Working to Advance Rochester's Diversity. United Parents Working to Advance Rochester's Diversity. And also didn't hurt any that John Powell, who at the time was the National Legal Director of the ACLU. He was on my runners back at Southeastern in 1960, you know, when I was coaching him, and he became the National Legal Director of the ACLU. He called this board president because the board for a while in Rochester got intimidated the same way the board in Madison had got intimidated. And I had written this booklet, this planning booklet called Telford's Telescope, which had some egalitarian commentary in it that some community members took exception to. So you know, they were not happy with this booklet, and the board pulled the booklet out of circulation for a while. But then the board also put a gag order on me. And when I saw this happening, I said, so I called a press conference. You know, I realized that if I let them silence me, they could just, they could just fire me out of hand, you know, without me making any noise at all. So I called a press conference, and ultimately they had to re-release this publication, which ended up on television. I mean, mm-hmm. them trying to censor it had the reverse effect. But when they released, they attached a document to it, distancing themselves from it. I called that document the Skull and Crossbones. I was having a lot of fun with them at that time, you know, because I was a young fellow then, comparatively. Well, I was in my 50s then. You know, I'm 74.
Right. Right. So, who are some of the heroes that you've had in your life besides your dad, obviously?
My heroes? Well, yeah, my dad, definitely. You know, I was in awe of him and my grandfather. You know, I always followed their ancestral code. You know, they were lifelong fighters for the underdogs, and that's, you know, what made me become a lifelong fighter for the underdog. But my heroes, you got to look at it over the span of 70 years, you know. I would have to say Robert F. Kennedy, Nelson Mandela. A lot of people forget, but Emiliano Zapata, you know, the great Mexican revolutionary, is one of my heroes. Gandhi, Audie Murphy, my track coach at Wayne State, David L. Holmes, he's in the Michigan Hall of Fame. Joe Lewis, you know, he's my homie. Muhammad Ali, naturally. Sugar Ray Robinson's my big hero. I had pictures of him all over my wall. Jesse Owens, I had pictures of him all over my wall. Olympic champion out of Jamaica. And I'm not talking now about Usain Bolt. I'm talking about my contemporaries. You know, when I was in high school, I had pictures of the 1952 Olympic 400-meter champion George Roden out of Jamaica up on my wall. And I'd have to name as one of my heroes Charlie Jenkins, you know, the 1956 Olympic 400-meter champion of Villanova. He was my big rival. You know, I raced against him four times. And you know, we had some real, real good races. The reason why, I name most of those folks, the non-athletes, except them for a league, they fought indomitably for what was right. And in the case of the athletes, including Ali, they had only themselves to depend upon in the arena. You know, it's not like football or basketball. And I play a little football, but in fact, I play a lot of football. But they were nearly invincible in the arena. And in track and boxing, you know, were individual sports. To the extent that even though I was one of the world's best quarter milers, I found Roden and Jenkins very hard to beat. You know, although I did beat them. I felt like apologizing to Roden when I beat him because he was my hero in high school. You know, back in 52, you know, I was a junior in high school when he was winning the Olympics 400 for Jamaica. But Owens, of course, was my all-time idol, you know, in track. A lot of that having to do, you know, with the Berlin Olympics and all the politics involved there. Lewis, one of my all-time idols for beating Max Schmeling, even though Schmeling was not a Nazi. You know, that was kind of a setup. You know, he was a German, but he was not a Nazi. Sugar Ray Robinson was my all-time hero. He was my number one all-time hero of all of them. I saw him fight when I was 7 years old. My dad took me to Olympia to see him fight when I was 7 years old. And I saw him fight again in 1961. I saw him knock out the Canadian champion, Wilf Greaves, at Cobo Hall in Detroit. So you're talking about the span of how many years, from 1943 to 1961? And this man was a magician of the ring. I mean, he could, he could knock you out retreating, you know. He'd outbox you, he'd outpunch you, he'd do whatever. And when he was fighting in the 60s, he was already way over the hill, which made his fights more exciting because they were, he was evenly matched with his opponents then. You know, he had to draw on all of his old-time knowledge and skills to win. But, yeah, Ray Robinson came out of Detroit, you know, moved to New York, and was just, he's been called the greatest fighter pound for pound of all time. And I would have to say that he has always been my number one idol.
Right. So tell me some more stories about, maybe during the civil rights times or civil rights era. Obviously you witnessed a lot of different scenarios being a white person. I think you were like mostly in black neighborhoods growing up.
Yeah, mixed, you know. The 16th Street and McGraw area, that whole quadrangle, you know, 16th Street, McGraw, Linwood, Marquette, and a little bit further, you know, out, was one of the few truly integrated neighborhoods in the city at the time. And it was becoming more African American. I went to school at Esterbrook with a lot of black classmates, and then to high school at Northwestern until I got kicked out of Northwestern. It was always a situation where I would be, anytime I saw somebody picking on my homies, you know, I would, I would take exception to that. One of the stories that I tell in the book was when my teammates and I, we had a really good relay team, the Detroit Track Club, just after I graduated from Wayne State. I was world ranked, you know, in the 400 meters,
mm-hmm.
440 yards. The Detroit Athletic Club, which was a very posh organization, and it was also an all-white membership, you know, a bunch of rich guys, you know, the Detroit Athletic Club.
Right.
They saw, you know, they were reading about me in the paper, and allowed us how they wanted, they approached me and asked me if they could, if I would like to have them sponsor me, you know, to some of the meets out in the East, you know, the Invitational. And I said, sure, I'd love to have you do that. I come as a package. You know, I've got these three teammates, and, we've got a really good relay team, too. We run individual races, but we also run, you know, we run together on this relay team, 4x220, 4x200,
right.
880 relay team. And they said, well, we just want you. You know, we don't want your teammates. And
mm-hmm.
I said, well, I'm a package. You know, you take me and my teammates or you don't get me. My teammates, of course, all three of them are black. And,
right.
You know, the ironic part of that was that the relay team broke the world record for the 880-yard relay a little while after that. But I don't think those guys at the Detroit Athletic Club cared, you know. I don't think they'd have cared if we'd broken the universal record for Mars. You know, they just
were. Well, they didn't sponsor you after all then.
Oh no. They were saying, you know, another one that I tell the story in the book, when I was in Pennsylvania, the Penn Relays, Wayne State University ran in a race called the College Class of America Mile Relay Championship, and we had time faster than 48 other teams. We won these plaques. These big bronze, we won a big bronze plaque. It was quite a prestigious thing, you know, to win a race at the Penn Relays, a relay race. So now our coach didn't have a lot of money, you know, because they didn't budget track, you know, very very well at Wayne State. But he decided he was going to give us steak dinners, you know, on the way home. So on the way home, we're in this restaurant right on the Pennsylvania Ohio border, and we sat and we sat and we sat. This is a real luxurious restaurant. And finally, you know, the coach realized what was going on. We got up and left. You know, they weren't going to serve my teammates. Again, it was another black team. You know, not the one from the Detroit track. Although one of the guys was the same. That was Billy Smith. He held the world record in low hurdles. Me, Billy Smith, Cliff Hatcher, and a guy from the islands named Ralph Williams. He was from St. Kitts. We went and drove into the night. Ended up having hot dogs and hamburgers in this little midnight diner. You know, the college champions of America are eating in this little midnight diner. But all of these things pretty much radicalized me. I was running on the United States team in touring team in Italy, and one of my teammates was my buddy Ira Murchison. He was out of Chicago. He held the world record in the 100 meters, 10 1/10 seconds, 10 1/10. Yeah, that was back when they had, you know, the old fashioned tracks. Ira would have been running about 9.6, you know, if he'd been on one of these rubber tracks now.
Right.
But I had won all my races, but I was getting tired, and because I was running 400 meters, you know, which is really taxing, particularly when you got, you know, 100 feet in Italy and in Spain and Portugal and Southern Europe. We were running a lot of races in Southern Europe, and I can remember I was losing muscle. You know, I was you know, I was under my running weight. I was running really light. I'd gone under 160 pounds. My best runaway is 165 pounds. So I couldn't even lift up my suitcase. And I can remember Ira lifted my suitcase up for me one time when we were going, getting on a train from Madrid to Portugal, and to Lisbon. And I said, man, I'm ready to go home, you know. And I said, you know, they're getting closer and closer. I was running 46, you know, and then there's 47, and then there's 47.5, and then, you know, I'm winning by 10 yards, 3 yards, 1 yard. By the time I got to Portugal, I won by about a foot, you know. And because, you know, we were facing national champions, and we were facing fresh opponents. Every time, you know, AAU, you know, they got their pound of flesh out of you. So anyway, I was the AAU. I was a National Amateur Athletic Union that controlled the sport of track and field in the United States at that time. So Ira said, "No, I don't feel like going home." He said, "I go home." He said, "You know, I'm going to be cleaning latrines, you know, for my half track scholarship at Western Michigan University." And I remember saying to myself, you know, because I had encountered Ardalion Ignatiev, who was the Russian champion, you know, the Soviet Union champion. And he was, you know, he had a villa on the Black Sea, you know. I mean, they were taking care, you know, the Iron Curtain countries were really taking care of their athletes. And here is the world record holder in the 100 meters, you know, cleaning latrines in a dormitory at Western Michigan University. And I'm saying to myself, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. I had already been radicalized, you know, but I guess this ultra radicalized me, you know, when I saw some of these things occurring.
Maybe you probably just saw so many things traveling with your teammates in different countries and you know, being in the different countries, I guess.
Was that a question? Because if it wasn't,
were you treated differently in other countries than you were treated here in your own country?
Yeah, you know, my African-American teammates on the United States team were treated like kings, you know, in Europe. And I guess, you know, to a certain extent, when they were running, they were treated like kings here. But when they weren't running, they certainly weren't. You know, in 1957, I turned down an opportunity to run in the Sugar Bowl track meet. Quarter mile in the Sugar Bowl because they drew the color line. You know, I wouldn't go down there, and I told the reporters about that. You know, it's not so long ago. I try to tell my kids, you know, the kids that I was teaching in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008 at Finney, what the circumstances as recently as 50 years ago were like. Not just in the South, but also up in the North. It was not a good environment. Rob, you might be familiar, you know, with some of that, even though you're a lot younger than I am. But you could probably tell some stories about that, about Detroit in those days too.
Well, I actually grew up in Arizona. Rob is from Detroit, so. I don't know a whole lot about Detroit except for what he tells me.
Yeah, well, it was not a good place, you know, for black kids to be growing up. I can remember one time the cops, when I was coaching at Southeastern, the cops took my best half miler and put him in jail simply because he was riding in a car with one of his buddies who didn't have a license. So they arrested him too. And he was kind of a mouthy kid, you know, when he was mistreated, when this was definitely mistreatment. So they beat him, and they were transferring from jail to jail, and they weren't feeding him. And one of my kids came to me, "Coach, you know, they got Ulysses, you know, he's down at the 5th Precinct, you know, I better go down there and try to get him out." I went down, he'd already been transferred, you know, I was tracing him. The cops didn't like to see me coming because, you know, I was pretty much an advocate for my kids. And there was a handful of coaches in Detroit, white coaches in Detroit, in those bad old days, you know, who were advocates for their kids. And they were necessary advocates. They, you know, what they did for the kids was very necessary. It was needed.
Right, of course. And how do you feel the election of Barack Obama has changed race relations in the United States?
Well, you know, my wife's African American. We campaigned for Obama in Macomb County, which they did not expect to carry in Michigan, Macomb County, Michigan, because we have a house, we have this big house and a little lake out there. I live and vote in Detroit. You know, I got a place on the river, but. Out in Macomb County, we were doing telephone campaigns for Obama, and the Obama campaign did not give us a lot of operatives because they had already written off Macomb County. But you know what? We carried Macomb County. It was narrow, but we carried Macomb County. What has his election done for race relations? If anything, you know, it might have set him back a little bit because, you know, all these crazies have been coming out of the woodwork. Eventually, Obama will prevail. He will go down as a turning point president, as probably one of the greatest presidents the country has ever had. I say this because, you know, he came upon a wish. We had an Obama in 1968, but they killed him. You know, that was Robert Kennedy. If Robert Kennedy had not been assassinated, and he was assassinated right on the heels of the King assassination. King was in April, Kennedy was in June. If that had not happened, we wouldn't have got Richard Nixon, for one thing, and Kennedy would have been elected. There wasn't any question that he would have been elected, and he would have egalitized the country, revolutionized the country, just by the very strength of his personality and the righteous mode that he approached politics in. It took us several decades to reverse what Nixon did, what Reagan did, what the first George Bush, who wasn't really a bad president, but the second George Bush, good Lord. I mean, this is a man, you know, who took us into war under false pretenses over oil. I mean, you know, that was a treasonous thing to do. You know, Bush and Cheney belong on death row, both of them. As far as I'm concerned, so do these five Supreme Court members that made corporations equivalent to common citizens. You know, this recent 5-4 vote. I mean, that was just appalling. I mean, they all belong on death row. They're all traitors.
Right. And what five things would you like to see changed about public education in America today?
Well, I'm hoping against hope that Arne Duncan, you know, will de-emphasize his present concern with standards until he can recognize that, you know, before we even address standards, because. I mean, education in America, for the most part, I mean, they're doing okay in suburban districts, but the urban centers are a disaster. I mean, a total disaster. One thing President Obama has to do immediately, and he's going to have to do it through Arne Duncan, his Secretary of Education, is to get an education bill passed that will include significant money attached to real reform for inner city schools, longer school days and years, mandated tests for prospective administrators and teachers to pass, anti-nepotism clauses. And I could, you know, I could write a whole book about that and the way that nepotism problem, you know, has gone down in Detroit. And administrators aren't getting evaluated. Instructional staff isn't getting appropriately evaluated. It should happen annually. And I think, you know, I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but maybe even the abolition of teacher tenure. But I'm not sure of that. You know, I'm an old union guy. I come from a union family. I was a union rep, you know, back in the early 1960s at high school. But, you know, we've got to do something radical to turn the situation around, because you got kids coming into high school now, and it's not just in Detroit. You know, they call Detroit the whipping boy. You know, our scores are lowest in the country, blah, blah, blah. It's all true. You know, they were. But it's only a matter of degree. You know, we've got to teach these kids to read. You know, we got to teach them to read. They're coming into the ninth grade in the high schools in Detroit, except for a couple of elite schools, not able to read. They're reading at the third, fourth grade level, and the poor principals are getting blamed for this, and so they get reconstituted and they get shuffled around. But you know, they're getting kids. You know, I mean. I never forget, there's an old story about that king in England, you know, who waved his scepter at the waves and was going to command the waves to go back. King Canute, I think his name was. Well, that's what Bush was like, with this No Child Left Behind. You know, he was waving his scepter at the waves. There was no rich child left behind, is what it was. And they got to scrap that whole thing. They got to take care of the dropout problem. They got to take care of the violence problem. And I have some solutions for that. I offered to do the Detroit superintendency for free, but unfortunately they had corrupt board members. Some top administrators were corrupt. They wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole. In fact, even the superintendent, the Connie Calloway, came up from Missouri. You know, when they got rid of her, she was out here to the lake. And I'm out at the lake right now, even though it's frozen. But it's good ice skating, you know, good ice skating. Anyway, she told me, she said, John, the minute I walked in the door, they were warning me against you. You know, they said you were crazy, but I wasn't crazy. You know, I knew what had to be done, and I can tell you what has to be done, not just in Detroit, but in East L.A., in Chicago, in Cincinnati, in St. Louis, in New York. What needs to happen is, number one, they gotta lower that class size in the first and second grade, make sure those kids don't get out of the second grade without being able to read. And the kids that they already got who are problems in the high schools and some of the junior high schools, they got to get those misbehaviors out of there, put them in special settings, small settings, surround them with security, with social workers, with remedial reading teachers, with truant officers, give them a principal who's battle-hardened and cares, and then, you know, just squeeze the financial balloon to do that. It won't cost any money. Let the class sizes go up a little bit, you know, in the schools that they're leaving behind, because those kids are behaving, those kids are trying to learn. But you get a high school like Finney with only maybe 1,800 kids in it. All it takes is a couple hundred kids. They'll create chaos. You know, those kids are the ones that need the most help, and they're not getting it.
Right. We have just a few more minutes, and I want to ask you a couple more questions here. Do you have any regrets or unfinished business?
Oh yeah, I want to get my story out, really. My unfinished business is marketing this book,
right.
Dr. John Telford. You know, that's my book, A Life on the Run, Seeking and Safeguarding Social Justice. It's a book that every educator across the country, at least every urban educator, should read. www.alifeontherun.com, www.alifeontherun.com. They can call my publisher, too. He's at 586-979-2077 to order the book, 586-979-2077. But the best way to get it is just to go to the website, www.alifeontherun.com. It's also at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Can be ordered.
So they could probably just Google A Life on the Run, and they would get all the information also, as far as where to order it.
Yes.
Okay, and we'll ask you one last question here. If you could be known for just one thing, what would it be and why?
Well, that's kind of a tough one. I guess that I tried all my life to right wrongs, particularly in regard to the undereducation of Black Americans. I've dedicated my life and career to that because it's something that, if it doesn't happen, a substantial percentage of our human potential is being wasted in this country, and we cannot afford to do that.
Right. Well, John, it's been very informative having you on our show tonight, and I think we must have lost Rob to some technical difficulties while during his travels.
Sure, what happened to Rob?
Oh, he's with us in spirit.
He hit another snowstorm. Who knows? And coming out of Detroit, we had a pretty good bout with the snow. I'm snowed in out here at 21 Mile Road in Van Dyke.
Yeah, he was snowed in and you know, couldn't leave yesterday and finally got out today. So who knows what's going on out there, but hopefully they're safe. We'd just like everyone to go to the website and get Mr. Talbert's book, A Life on the Run. That's at www.alifeontherun.com. And again, we'd just like to thank you for joining us, John, and look forward to meeting you in person one day when we're out in Detroit.
Anytime, come on out to the house, we'll do a light.
All right, sounds like a good plan.
Okay, kid.
All righty. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with your book, and we'll definitely keep you on our websites, and people can also go there and get your address for your book as well.
Thank you. I hope they do. I hope they spread the word to their cousins and brothers and sisters and uncles and teachers.
Exactly. We need more people like you, not only teachers, but just people in general, to be, to help.
Well, I'm passing the baton. I'm passing the baton now. That book is my way of passing the baton. I've been doing it half a century. Now it's their turn to do the same thing.
Exactly. Well, you're an example to all of us, and hopefully your book will touch many, and we wish you all the success.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will talk to you later.
Okay.
And we'd like to thank all the listeners we didn't have any callers tonight, but all the listeners that joined us, Mr. John Telford, and join us next week with Mr. Big John. He's a former Blood Gang member from L.A., and we'll hear his experiences and what he's doing now to be a gang interventionist and mentor to the youth in the L.A. area. We'd like to also, just wish everyone a happy Valentine's Day for this coming week. And we'll be back next Wednesday night. And we're just going to go out with a song tonight, the remix, The Streets Don't Love You Back. And join us next week, 11:30 Eastern Time, 8:30 Central or Pacific Time. Good night.
What's up, what's up? This RB checking in. But the streets don't love you back. The movement is on, baby. Letting you know, me and LD talking about that thug / drug life. Let me tell you a little lesson, players. In these streets, baby, they'll never love you back. Trust that.
In the street, no one can touch you. In the street, love if you want to. But know the street, they don't love you, they don't love you.
Everybody's around here talking about all that thug life, player. Talking about that drug dealing thing. Tell you, baby, it's about getting your life together, getting your head on tight, doing something with your life and stop destroying your community. and stop destroying yourself, baby. But when the people come at you, they come for real, player. Homeboys on my team done got 400 million before, baby. 100 million, baby. Now they sitting on death row, baby. That's where you wanna be, player. Cause the drug game is washed up. The thug game is washed up, baby. They put it in our communities, baby, and they tell us off the top, yeah, you can make this, you can make that. But once they come for you, game over, lights out. Do what you feel, do what you wanna do, baby, but join the movement. It's the streets, baby, they don't love you back. It's the streets, baby, they don't love you back. Come on, come on.
In the street, no one's above you. In the street, no one can touch you. In the street, love
yeah, yeah.
If you want.
This track here is a track of knowledge, you feel me? Want all young brothers and sisters across America to understand that the drug game, the thug life, that's all washed up right now. Take heed, learn from players that can live that life, you feel me? Much love to my man, the real Freeway Ricky Ross. Jeff Step down May 4th, we sending you much love out there to Cali, you feel me? Much love to everybody across state to state who roll with the movement. It's time to open your eyes up, people. It's time to rise up above all this street thing, you feel me? It's a better way. Let's do this.
It's moments like this when my back's against the fence that I say fuck the fence. Life is just I gotta go and get a bit. Got get caught up in moves. Shit, I'm strong. It started from my home, so I'm at home when pressure's on. We all alone when we born. We all alone when we die. We need to get our shit together. We can make it if we try. Can probably make it if you cry. But I hate it when you whine. And if all is true is up, then you can take it when you die. I'm on my grind, cause all I got is time. But maybe it's enough. But if it's not, then let me know. Cause I feel like I'm on bus. I'm overstuffed with propaganda. This is slander. Lies, tried to slick the public and then wonder why there's crimes and murders on the rise, cause we ain't got a dime. Shit, I'ma hurt some fucking body, you can see it in my eyes. I lie awake sometimes at night and ponder how to get ahead, jump out of bed paranoid, I'm going backwards instead. Feel like my feet is full of lead, cause I just can't move, freestyle life off the head, cause I don't know what to do. I need to make a couple moves. Ooh, I need to make a couple moves. I need to make a couple moves, but I gotta stay free, cause each and everything I do and say affects my seed. Decide what's the truth, separated from fallacy. Separate what I want from the things that I need, and try to make a way for everything to be okay. Stay focused on my goals, so you never stray away. Let the past be the past, and your future's okay. Pay attention to the present, living in it every day. Come
let
on.
Let us all be checking back in with you, like I said. It's that trap of knowledge, let you young brothers and sisters understand that, hey, the street life, that's a dead issue, that's a dead game, that's all washed up. Let's get our life together, let's do what we need to do. Let's love more, hate none. RB, love, one. Much love to Lucinda, my manager, and my man LD. Let's do it. 100. Out.